Statecraftiness is produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the lands of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We acknowledge their elders, past and present. I'm Gordon Peake, the host of Statecraftiness. I'm normally based in Washington, D.C., but I'm back over in Australia for a few weeks. I'm in Canberra now, and I'm speaking from a small, sleek, minimalist Maud Oz coffee shop that serves flat whites, cappuccinos, and chai lattes to some of the major statecrafters of Australia. I'm in a place called Ritual, and it's a couple of minutes' walk from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, one of the major institutions of the Australian government engaged in this great game of influence in the Pacific region. Ritual's got a bit of a feel of a living room for diplomats. There's lots of furrowed conversations going on around here, lots of people looking over their shoulder purposefully before leaning in for a crucial tete-a-tete. And I'm joined here by three normally much more silent than me members of the Statecraftiness team who play important behind-the-scenes roles. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves?
Hey, everyone. I'm Shanna Ryan, and I work behind the scenes assisting with production, managing the project and our guests, and also developing our promo content.
Hi, everyone. I'm Luther Canute, and I look after all things audio. I write and record the music and produce and mix each episode and occasionally lend a hand with some script writing as well.
All right. So you're like the sound crafter of the podcast, Luther. And final person, last but not least, is executive producer Mark Peter Nataras from Cultural Pulse. How was your break, Mark?
Look, I don't know if I had a break because I have been busy in between series one and series two of Statecraftiness working on multicultural fan engagement for the FIFA Women's World Cup in Australia and New Zealand. You may have heard about it. So yeah, I've had a really good time in between, but I did also notice that there have been other things happening in the world, like a conga line of visitors to the Pacific Islands. And I understand that the US president was meant to come down here. The Indian prime minister did, and then the French president made it down to the Pacific as well.
This new imperialism is the basis of a new colonialism. Let's be clear. And the French strategy is clearly to build with you the defense of this liberty of sovereignty in the region.
And then there was the summit of the Pacific leaders back in Washington, D.C., where you are.
Following our historic summit last year, I was honored to host all of you at the Pacific Islands Forum in the White House today. Like our forebears during World War II, we know a great deal of the history of the world will be written across the Pacific over the coming years. And like them, we owe it to the next generation to help write that story together.
All right, everyone's got their coffees of choice, so we can begin and focus on why we're here at Ritual, which is try to get planning started for season two. We've got a bit of a dilemma. I mean, we know these phrases like sequelitis, second album syndrome. I guess our challenge is, how do we try to do something with season two that keeps with the ethos of Statecraftiness and with the ethos of Professor Joanne Wallace's quest to figure out what works and what doesn't work in terms of influence in the Pacific? But we also want to do something that kind of looks and feels a little bit different.
That's exactly right, Gordon. You know what I've been saying, that the sequel's never as good as the original. So fingers crossed we can buck that trend. Look, I think what we did in the first series in many ways was to look at statecraft initiatives that we could see visibly in front of us, above the surface, if you like. I really loved the episode we did on police reform. It was so tangible. We got such interesting feedback from people who could relate to, you know, working on those police reform programs in the Pacific, both the positive impacts and the challenges that they brought. And they're the sorts of things that you see when you travel to Timor-Leste and the Pacific Islands. You see the impacts of those. You see them advertised, for example, and you meet people who've worked in those programs. those are the kind of things that are all on the surface. But I've been interested for this series, series two, to look at topics and subjects that we can't see as explicitly, those kind of issues that float below the surface a bit, the undertow of state craftiness, if you like. So let's see how we go.
Mark was right. We think of statecraft often as something that is visible and tangible and touchable. But a lot of statecraft is also less visible. And the project Mark was working on, the FIFA Women's World Cup in Australia, is an example of that.
Up against Millie Bright. Kerr goes for it. Oh! How about that?
Mark is a former aid bureaucrat, and once an aid bureaucrat, always an aid bureaucrat. He always loves brandishing a good statistic to show effectiveness. And as we were getting the season together, he pointed to a survey report which captured the sentiments of Australians and showed they thought that Australia's international reputation and influence was enhanced a great deal by the FIFA Women's World Cup. That figure increased by almost 50% of the percentage taken prior to the World Cup. And in the Pacific, there was particular attention to a daughter of both Ireland and Papua New Guinea who played for Australia, an up-and-coming star by the name of Mary Fowler, whose exploits were watched and celebrated back in one of her ancestral homes, outside of Port Moresby, which was painted during the tournament in the Australian colours of wattle and green.
Our village is mainly big followers of volleyball and cricket. But because of Mary, we are now switching our focus to soccer. Our small grandchildren cried for us to go and buy soccer balls at Brian Bell. They have made lots of money from our village, just because of the impact of Mary, and all of their soccer balls are sold out. So are the yellow and green shirts. The impact of Mary playing is hitting Port Moresby as well as Kirakira. When she is playing, all the TVs come out and are placed on the veranda or the yard, and everyone comes out to support her.
This is the sort of acclaim that the average statecraft activity that we talked about in season one, like a training or a launch of a corporate plan, doesn't get. And it points to the influence of something called soft power in terms of influencing attitudes and behaviours, which is one of the angles that Professor Joanne Wallace at University of Adelaide has turned her attention to as part of the wider statecraftiness project.
It was very famously introduced by Joseph Nye about 20 years ago.
Well, power is the ability to get what you want from others, and you can do it three ways. You can do it with coercion, you can do it with payment, or you can do it with attraction and persuasion. Coercion and payment I call hard power. The ability to get what you want through attraction and persuasion is soft power.
It was the idea, as we have discussed, that non-material power can be influential. And in his formulation, it was particularly looking at America, and it was looking at things like American culture, movies, music, just the idea of America, the fact that that can have an attraction for others, that can give them a positive view of America, and therefore that they can be influenced by America. In our project, we kind of unpacked that definition a bit more. Our project definition is that it's the intentional deployment of mostly non-material resources. So here, it's not building a building or sending a... They may have soft power effects. They may help improve the image of a country, but, you know, we consider them separately. So the deployment of mostly non-material resources to influence recipient states, actors, or individuals to develop positive beliefs, attitudes, or opinions about the partner state or the partner state's worldview. And we've done this deliberately. We've unpacked it deliberately because we're really interested in the subtle ways that soft power can work, not necessarily to directly shape state A and its population, develop a positive view of state B. That might be quite difficult. But state B might be able to use soft power to change the way that state A and its population see the world in ways that suit state B. So we want to capture the fact that you can't directly draw a line between soft power attempt and change in an attitude. It might be a lot more amorphous, but in many ways, the more amorphous it is, the more effective it is, because it happens without people realizing that it's happened. about a recent example of Australian efforts to exercise soft power in the region, we can think about Australia's support for a Papua New Guinean team to join the NRL. Now, I confess, I grew up in Melbourne. I am an AFL person all the way, so NRL does not resonate very strongly with me. But I fully acknowledge that there are a lot of people to the south of Victoria, in Queensland, New South Wales, and Papua New Guinea, and many of our neighbours who do really love rugby league. And it is, I think, valuable for Australia to be reminding ourselves, as well as our neighbours in the Pacific, that we do have a lot of these shared passions and similarities with each other. And that could, you know, potentially have a soft power game. As I say, I emphasise, it works both ways. It's reminding Australians as much as it is reminding our Pacific neighbours. We go back a long way. We have a history. It's a complicated history. In Papua New Guinea, we were the colonial administrator, and we haven't yet potentially really come to terms and reconciled our history in Papua New Guinea. But this is a really important way to sort of start having those conversations and saying, look, why do so many Papua New Guineans play, you know, are interested in the NRL? Why, when State of Origin is on, is my Facebook feed and my Twitter feed full of Papua New Guineans talking about State of Origin? It's because we have this long history with them. Let's talk about that history, good and bad, and let's talk about the relationships that we have built and we continue to build on that history.
You saw it, but did you see the picture of the Prime Minister's 13 that came to Port Moresby? I mean, the levels of excitement that greeted them at the airport was really just extraordinary. And there were thousands of people who came out to meet them, and no obvious security problems.
Well, Gordon, if you want to know about how soft power works, religion, sports, food, and other things, the people to talk to are the Pacific team that we have at University of Adelaide. I've been really fortunate in the last year or so that I've been joined here by Maima Koro. She's a Pacific Research Fellow working on another project that we have beyond this one. Derek Futaasi, who is another Pacific Research Fellow, and Priestley Hubru. And I think they will be far better qualified than me to speak to you about what it's like to be on the other end of all these soft power efforts in the Pacific.
And so off on the quest we went, into the studio at the University of Adelaide. And we began with Maima Koro, who has impeccable sports credentials herself, especially when it comes to netball.
I did play for the Samoa national team, but also played other sports in terms of, like, I was drafted in to be high jump for the South Pacific Games. You just kind of put your hand up for everything so you can just get to experience and travel.
So you're the perfect person to talk to about the soft power of sports. So we have the Pacific Games in Honiara, and we've also got Australian support for a National Rugby League team in Papua New Guinea to compete in the National Rugby League. And the tournament will have finished by the time we release this, but you've also got a lot of Pacific teams that are in the Rugby Union World Cup taking place over in France. So sports and diplomacy have always been intertwined all over the world. Can you talk about how politics and diplomacy and sports are intertwined in the Pacific?
I think, you know, it's one of those things that Pacific communities have always known, you know, about the value of sports. So there's an economic aspect of that, obviously, and that there is a direct benefit to those players and to their families and to their communities. But more broadly than that, I think it's well acknowledged that sport actually, you know, it's borderless, you know, that it creates all of that kind of relationships. And one of the things I found going through sports is that there's a discipline and there's a relationship that stays with you right through your whole life. You know, that, and that's the value of sport. So I think from the Pacific perspective, it's always been there. It's always been there. I don't think it's always, you know, well appreciated or well acknowledged. One of the things that Pacific leaders did, I remember, because of this idea of, at the time, it was seen as economic, but it was really about diplomacy, that leaders took up that agenda foreign leaders took up the sports agenda, you know, way back in the early 2000s, you know, and that was to try and see the value, the economic value, but also the relational value of sports. Now, it was fast forward to that. I remember, like, in the Pacific Prevention of Domestic Violence program, they put the emphasis on sports diplomacy and get those sports people out to talk about, you know, it's not okay. So there are so many, I think you can unpack that on so many different levels about sports and the value of that, not just to Pacific communities, but more broadly, appreciation of talent, the appreciation of commitment. But it's not just a personal commitment. I mean, we've seen that every time a sports person gets up and there's an accolade about them, the first thing that they acknowledge is their faith and then their community.
And as Solomon Islander Priestley Habru explained, political leaders in the region are well attuned to the importance of sportscraft as statecraft.
In terms of sports in the Pacific, people take it up as a lesser activities, but then the leaders, as Maima said, started to realize the importance of sports diplomacy as well. So you've seen examples like, you know, Anthony Albanese and James Murphy watching a State of Origin together. You have Prime Minister Albanese watching the futsal rules and the Solomon Islands futsal soccer just last week. And you have the Prime Minister of Vanuatu coming to watch Brian Kaltak when he was playing in the A-League final.
And you've got this amazing kind of melding or fusing together of sports and statecraft and diplomacy and competition, because in Honiara, you've got the Pacific Games and countries are rushing over themselves in a race for influence in terms of what's being built for those games and which athletes are being supported to perform well in those games.
There are about 80 athletes now in China at the moment. Yes. Just training for 3 months ahead of the South Pacific Games. So, you know, countries are supporting sports and things like that, and they see the importance of sport diplomacy as one of the statecraft thing, I think. I think futsal, being one of the sports that will be introduced in these games, that's where Solomon's quite good in beach soccer and futsal and, you know, the small courts of soccer and football. So I'm hoping they, as a host, we wanted to win more medals, and I think that's one of the reasons that we are trying to host, and also getting a lot of medals by hosting the games.
The games are part of a big game of geopolitical football. As well as China training the athletes, China is also building the stadium in Honiara, while Australia is refurbishing dormitories at 6 schools in Honiara that will accommodate visiting athletes and officials. And they're providing sports equipment for the Solomon Islands National Institute of Sport to assist Solomon Islands athletes, and a temporary marine center that will be used as the venue for open water sports events. According to an analysis from Professor Stephen Howes of the Australian National University, all this support to sportscraft constitutes over 10% of Australia's total aid to Solomon Islands. I asked Derek Futiasi about the soft power implications. I asked him if the games were generating excitement or a shrug of the shoulders in Honiara. And Derek's answer surprised me.
Well, in terms of the current climate in the Solomons as we prepare for the games, having the opportunity to talk with other Solomon Islanders in the past few weeks, some insiders or those in Honiara whom I've had the opportunity to talk to said that the games, in a way, is a unifying factor. So the current climate in terms of our preparation towards the game seems to encourage the idea of collectiveness as well. And they are seeing this game as a factor that unifies us, so that when these people or outsiders come for the games, we have a united front to deal with the games.
Next door to Solomon Islands is Papua New Guinea, where another bit of high-octane sports craftiness is playing out. Australia is championing a project to get a Papua New Guinean side into Australia's National Rugby League. This is a conversation that took place between Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Papua New Guinea Prime Minister James Marape last year in Fiji.
Well, we have to look at team eventually in the NRL, Fan Jam perhaps from the Pacific as well.
We've placed a bid. It's not within your responsibility, but it will help a lot of you assets. You're the number one man in Australia and you're a rugby league man yourself.
And then when Prime Minister Albanese addressed the Papua New Guinea Parliament early in 2023, he emphasised the importance of the team again.
Australia and Papua New Guinea are the closest of neighbours. We are the greatest of friends. When Prime Minister Marape and I watched the State of Origin together in Suva last year, he said there are only 3 days that your country stops. Game one, game two, and game three of State of Origin. And today I affirm my view that I want to see a PNG-based team, Pacific Islanders, competing in the National Rugby League competition.
A few months afterwards, $5.5 million was allocated to support the development of rugby league in Papua New Guinea and to make a business case for a team.
We're in regular discussions both with the PNG government and the NRL and the PNG NRL bid team. They've got to go through their internal processes and the NRL really have to work out how they want to run this whole process. But we certainly, from a federal government point of view, recognise there is a huge diplomatic benefit and a nation-building benefit from this initiative.
That was Pat Conroy, Minister for Defence Industry, Minister for International Development and the Pacific, talking about the plan. Now, as every fan knows, games rarely ever go to plan. And we wanted to find out how this game was playing out. And so we spoke to some people in the stands, but first we went to the coach's dugout.
My name is Stanley Tappan. I'm from a little town up in the Highlands, far north of Mount Hagen, province called Enga Province.
Stanley Tappan is rugby league royalty. He's a former hooker for the national side. He coached them in the Rugby World Cup in England in 2022, and until recently was manager of the SP Hunters, the Papua New Guinea Rugby League side who play in Australia in the state-based Queensland Cup. And Stanley was well across the inside ball of what's happening on the bid.
Yeah, well, look, the Australian government, they've supported, you know, us in trying to get a team in the NRL. And it's, you know, the hype and the, you know, support when it was first initially announced, man, it had a big positive impact on everyone in the country. You know, actually realizing that we will be a team in the NRL, actually realizing that the competition that we watch every day, the competition that, you know, that stops the nation every day when there's a big game on, when the State of Origin's on, when the grand final's on, having a team that we will own or that we will call our own team, that was huge for us. When the Prime Minister of Australia announced that, yeah, it was huge. And they were doing, before the actual announcement, there was a lot of work being done, not as heavily as after the announcement, but there was still that connection, like the Prime Minister's 13 game, it's been on every year. That ties in with educational messages. So there was a relationship with Australia and us prior to that, with the Hunters being on and with all this. To be in the NRL, we have to tick a lot of boxes. And prior to the announcement, I think we were starting to do that. We've got a state-of-the-art facility in Port Moresby, the National Football Stadium, that, you know, that's hosted international games, World Cup games. We've got high performance experts within the NRL that were coming up and doing work within our systems to get it up to speed with refereeing, junior development, the national leagues all throughout the country, not just Port Moresby. They had to come up and implement certain things that had to meet requirements within the NRL. And that was being done prior to the actual announcement. But now that the actual announcement has been made and there's actually financial backing, that's just pushed everything even further, more deep within PNG, more deep within the other centres in PNG and other provinces. So we've got a lot of ex-NRL support staff that have come up and implemented those things, which is good to see, because I think we have to, like I said before, tick a lot of boxes before we actually get the green light. So there's a lot of work being done. The excitement, you can feel it everywhere.
And Stanley, if I remember correctly, didn't Papua New Guinea, way back in the early 2010s, it was without Australian government support, if I remember, try to join the NRL already? I mean, there was this little office that the Papua New Guinea Rugby League had in the Holiday Inn, and the purpose of that office was to prepare Papua New Guinea for the Rugby League. And we should probably describe the Holiday Inn for our listeners. You and I know the place really, really well. It's this Graham Greene novel of a hotel. Lots of expat government advisors live there and sometimes drown their sorrows of an evening at the hotel bar. Often the most honest conversations about statecraft are to be heard there before last orders are called. I think the Rugby League office was between the beautician and the education capacity development program and about 10 yards from that bar. Am I remembering it right? Whatever happened to that bid?
Yeah, there was an initial bid. You are right. It was set up at the Holiday Inn at the bottom, at the ground floor there. They did have an office, and that's where the PNG RFL office was originally located, at the Holiday Inn. Now, obviously, the head office is at the National Football Stadium where all the operations and where everything is. Back then, there was a bid process in place. Now, there was a lot of money being pumped back then as well. So actually, I was probably starting off my coaching career when that happened. So it was exciting, but not as meaningful, not as in-depth as this one. I think there was probably a lot more politics than like misuse, or if I can, I'm careful not to use the wrong word here, but I don't think it was politically, not done properly. Whereas now you can see both countries are really supportive. Back then, I think we had a lot of misinformation. We had a lot of, we probably weren't smarter back then, whereas now we've learned from that and now we're just slowly ticking the boxes where we need to. There was a lot of hype back then. You know, we didn't have the connections as we do now. We didn't have the hunters as we do now. So we didn't have a national football stadium as we do now. And yeah, it was a bit gray in my memory back then. But now I think, learning from what happened back then and having the right people in place, connecting both PNG and Australia, not just in terms of rugby league, but I think in government as well. You know, the government here in PNG and the right governance in Canberra in Australia, I think we've got the right people in there to push not just the sport, but you know, all the other government relations or the work we're doing outside of football is supportive of the actual bid that's happening now. So a lot better now.
I ended my interview with Stanley by asking him what was harder, a crunching tackle in the game of rugby league or a crunching tackle in the game of statecraft?
Being involved in rugby league, I feel that's the easy part, but the political side can be pretty brutal, and that's probably the hardest, I'd say. That's my honest opinion.
Rugby league is a tough game, but at least its rules are written down. And the man we sent out to the stands to interview the fans had a problem that many statecrafters have had over the years. He had a hard time explaining what he did.
I'm Ty Kyla. I work in media. I go around taking... Oh, what should I say? I work in media.
You're like a content provider. You make videos, you make audio, and we send you on a quest to go to try to ask Papua New Guineans in kind of the PMVs, which are the name for buses in Port Moresby, what their views were on Australia supporting the development of a Papua New Guinean side in the National Rugby League in Australia. Did anything surprise you when you were doing the interviews? I mean, are people aware of Australia supporting Papua New Guinea to join a team in the NRL? Is everyone excited, ready for it to happen?
Well, I got a mixed reaction. Most didn't know, and some, they went for it, and some went against it. But there's a general consensus as to what the answers were. The people didn't have confidence in our government and our side with the management of it all and with making it happen.
Yeah, so it is a good thing, but I don't know if it's the best thing. It's something a lot of Papua New Guineans want, but it's definitely not something that even more Papua New Guineans need. It would be 100 times better if we had better medical facilities, public schools, not just in Port Moresby, but across across the country.
PNG has a lot of other areas that could use a boost, so to speak. We're experiencing power and water cuts every other week in the nation's capital, and for Australia to donate freely $5.5 million to the PNG NRL bid just screams political agenda to me. And it would make more sense as well with the amount of interest Papua New Guinea has been getting in recent times from global superpowers like China, America, India, and France, to name a few. I think it's just a ploy to win points with our government, having known what rugby league means to the average Papua New Guinean. You could even say it's more like a religion to us, and that wouldn't be me overstating with the amount of emergency cases that pour into hospital every State of Origin night. The State of Origin nights are when we get the most violence-related cases in the ER at the hospital. Personally, I think the PNG NRL bid would breed more of these social issues, and for Australia to freely support that with a $5.5 million boost is quite alarming.
We'll only end up using 100,000 kina. Because the rest of the money will go into people's pockets.
I think most PNG citizens would want it to happen. Like it would be a good feel-good story, you know. It would make the most of the populace happy, given that everybody kind of just knows what rugby is straight out of the womb, so to speak. It would make the greater PNG happy.
Undoubtedly, it will give opportunity to so many talented Papua New Guinean aspiring professional rugby league players and all who aspire to follow in the footsteps of, say, Justin Olam or David Mead. Maybe there are ways for the Australian government to also assist with awareness when it comes to gambling addiction. Because what is maybe the all-encompassing point is that the Australian government and the appropriate oversight committee must consider the lasting impacts of promoting the NRL in a country where NRL players, both past and present, they're treated like gods. And I'm sure that if the appropriate bodies could establish dialogue with somebody on the ground, somebody who knows what I'm talking about, then they'll see how much of a problem it is.
When the team and I listen to Clyde's interviews, we find them really poignant and redolent of the hard scrabble and difficult lives that many people in Port Moresby have. Everyday challenges that could be soothed, but not necessarily addressed by a Papua New Guinean team in the NRL. Striking also was who the skepticism was directed at. Not Australia supporting the bid, but at the capacity of their own government to manage well and keep interest in a project of this sort. And this gets into questions of the capacity and interest levels of the Papua New Guinean government and its elite, an elite who are ever more courted by everyone from the presidents of the United States and France to the prime ministers of Australia and India, to manage what is expected of them. These are the sorts of questions that may get ventilated in the dressing rooms of statecraft, but never on the pitch itself. Next time around, we'll be looking at the soft power statecraft of television and a show called Pacific Islands Food Revolution, a program often referred to as the MasterChef of the Pacific. I'm Gordon Peake, the host and word crafter of Statecraftiness. Luther Knut is the sound crafter, and the executive production crafters are Joanne Wallace, Mark Nataras, and Shanna Ryan. Thanks for listening. We wonder if you could do us a favor and leave us a rating or review on your podcast app of choice. Or, if you've enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends, family, and fellow statecraft aficionados. This activity was supported by the Australian government through a grant by the Australian Department of Defence to the University of Adelaide. The views expressed are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Australian government, the Australian Department of Defence, or the University of Adelaide.